Hey guys, this is And the Writer Is, and I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of writers and artists over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life and the industry, politics, composition, whatever. If you ask me, songwriters are some of the most worldly and intelligent people I've ever come across. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. Now I'm co-producing this with my friend Joe London, who was nominated for a Grammy earlier this year for Best Country Song. He makes us sound like angels. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, go to Spotify and look up our playlist, And the Writer Is, or go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Oh, and if you enjoy this podcast, please rate us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. We really appreciate that effort.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This week's episode is with Ali Tamposi. She has the number 2 song on Top 40 Radio. It's Kygo's It Ain't Me featuring Selena Gomez. So we're really proud of her because when you hear this story, you're going to hear her roller coaster ride from being at literally the top, going literally to the bottom, and then literally back up to the top. Needless to say, this is going to be a very entertaining episode. But before we get to that, I wanted to talk about song math. Song math is essentially modern song composition. I mean, it hasn't changed all that much since Franz Schubert in the early 1820s. But without going to a history lesson of song composition and sonata form, the gist of it is that songs need to be somewhat symmetrical. There needs to be some sort of arc. I think there are 3 arcs. There's a melodic arc, a rhythmic arc, and a lyric arc. So when you talk about a melodic arc, as my friend Colby Calais once said, you start low and you end high. It's about framing titles. It's about framing all lyrics. Is there an antagonist as a listener? Is there a protagonist as a listener? The gist of it is that this is a very complicated conversation that we're not going to have in this intro. But we will get to process and composition at a later point on a separate kind of episode. Let's not worry about that now. In the meantime, here is And the Writer Is featuring Ali Tamposi. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Since she entered the game, today's guest has written 3 of the biggest songs in music. Her discography includes some of the greatest singers of our generation, Christina Aguilera, Kelly Clarkson, and Demi Lovato. Some of the biggest DJs of our generation, DJ Snake, Kygo, and Cedric Gervais. And some of the biggest pop stars of our generation, including Justin Bieber, Selena Gomez, and my favorite, herself. From West Palm Beach, Florida, this writer is only beginning her journey as she's knocking on the door of her 3rd number 1 pop record, Kygo's It Ain't Me, featuring Selena Gomez. The writer is my 2012 Aspen writing camp buddy, hey. Ali Tamposi.
I feel like the mariachi band should come in now. It's like, ding, 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 ding.
Is that a mariachi band?
It's
awesome.
A 1-man mariachi.
So you're still singing demos for some side cash.
Yeah, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
Do people ask you, like, yo, can you sing demos? Like, when did that stop? What was the moment where that stopped?
Well, I don't feel like I started becoming a good singer until I really discovered how to work with autotune. And then, like, I feel like I'm the most confident autotune singer there is. Without it, I mean, it's a different story. It's a different person. It's a different song. It's crazy.
It's so vulnerable to sing without autotune in an era where you're used to listening to autotune.
Yeah.
And I think people don't realize that, like, it's not as Adele's an amazing singer, but for people to assume that none of that's auto-corrected in any way is just like, that's...
I won't even touch a mic without the tune on full. and without the CLA, I mean, I need the whole thing. And it's just like, that's the most stimulating part for me, is jumping on the mic and freestyling melodies and kind of catching that flow and feeling like good about myself.
Do you record vocals at home?
No, I don't. I should. I mean, I went to audio engineering school, so I kind of feel like I wasted that degree.
Where did you go to school?
SAE. I actually went to school with, I was in the same grade as the Monsters and Strangers.
Oh, cool.
And the class, yeah, in Miami, we didn't really know each other, and there's only like 30 people per grade. And I ended up, like, flash forward 3 years later in a session with them, and I'm like, you guys look familiar. They're like, yeah. And we started talking, they're from Miami, and somehow SAE popped up. Yeah, we had the same teachers. Everything was really crazy. And they're utilizing their degree. And like some people, I can't even touch.
No, but you just said, you know, with the CLA, at least you know your CLA being the Chris Lord Alge plugin.
Right.
You know, like,
I know it works.
I
can't touch a computer. God forbid. Ask me to put on a loop and it's like the session crashes. It's so bad. It's embarrassing. I try and kind of leave that detail out, that I actually was an engineer at some point. I don't know. I think I cheated my way through that. I really did. I mean, I was too young. I was 17. Like,
you're from West Palm Beach, right?
Delray Beach, West Palm Beach, bounced around a bit.
Well, before you're 17, are you singing in bands or musical theater? Are you singing? I mean, where do you start?
Because
you're obviously a singer.
Right.
You know, are your parents singers?
My dad can play the piano pretty well. My mom is not. But at 14, I signed a production deal with Marty Cintron, who was in the band No Mercy. I think he still is in that. The song, Where Do You Go, My Lovely.
Wow.
So he signed me, developed me. We did a demo. And then he played it for Frank Farian, who is the voice behind Milli Vanilli. He owned a record label through Sony.
How did they find you?
Through my sister-in-law, who owns a modeling agency in Miami. And so she knew Marty and brought me in. And that's actually, so I owe a lot of this to Marianne, my sister-in-law, who just like was facilitating.
Wow.
And yeah, and so it's
so you have older siblings.
Yep. I have two older brothers and a younger sister and brother.
And she introduces you to them, and she's in Miami.
Yep.
Calls him, says, you got to hear my little sister. She's only 14, but she's incredible.
Yeah, it was perfect timing. He was looking for something to do because his band was kind of slowing down. And I learned a lot from him. He taught me how to play the guitar. And then he brought me to his label, which Frank Farian owned. And Frank Farian signed me to a record deal, which is crazy. So I signed a record deal. We made a whole album. I was actually working with Styles, who I don't think he goes by Styles anymore, but I just ran into him at Jay Cash's house 10 years later. He engineers and helps produce with like The Weeknd and Billions. What's his name? Danny Deep Styles. I'll show you a picture later, but you definitely know him. I ran into him. We made a whole album together, did a music video.
Were you writing, or were they giving you songs to?
I was writing.
So you're writing at 14 years old?
At this point, I was 16. I signed the demo deal at 14. Marty wrote my songs then. And then 16, started getting into the writing world. It was like a pop rock record, like all on analog. It was really cool. I made some money then.
And were those songs good?
Pretty good, like I think that was a sample. Actually, I have a music video for it. It's like God.
Can you look it up? Is it on YouTube?
No, but that one's going away. That one's staying somewhere in some vault. But yeah, so then after about a year and a half, that started to kind of fizzle out. So
why?
It's just there wasn't the funding, there wasn't, you know, they didn't have the right, like the
was it a record deal? Did he have a record deal signed to a major?
It was Sony, but it was like Sony Germany or something. So there was like just a complete disconnect. And then, so my dad was like, all right, you got to go to school. So SAE looks like it was only a year and a half. It was in Miami. It looked like the easiest thing to get through, which was so not the easiest thing.
Did you go to high school during all this?
I went to I actually did freshman year at School of the Arts, and then I homeschooled.
Okay.
After
so
that.
You got your GED before
yeah.
you went and did.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, and then so I'm in SAE at 17. Like, have no
what
idea.
What does SAE stand for?
School of Audio Engineering.
Okay, right.
And
seems logical.
I mean, I was put that not together, prepared for that. The amount of science and math, and I mean, these kids have been working on these on programs, Pro Tools, Reason, Logic, Cubase, and I was in there cutting tape and. We had to mix, mic and mix live drums. I don't know how I got through that. I know I had my guys though. I'd like hang out with after school to like, let me, like they'd tutor me and I was so stressed out. That was the most stressed out I've ever been. Cause if I just was at the very end and I knew like, if you fail your final, you fail and you've got to go back for another 6 months. So I was... Yeah, I made it through. Let's just say that I can't even go back there. It's just a heavy place.
When you finish that program and you are sitting there, you're like, I got the certificate, but I don't have any idea how to do any of it.
I went straight back into the
studio.
I have
a music degree, and I'm like, I can't read notation really for shit. I mean, I can kind of read vocal stuff, but like going through the like a music degree yeah. and being like, I mean, I guess I can.
Where did you go?
USC.
USC, okay.
But it was a lot of classical kids. I remember, like, side story, and I know this isn't my story, this is yours, but I had a music theory teacher who used to talk shit on pop music all the time. And she was a flautist, and she played in the orchestra, and I was like, you're in a 250-year-old cover band. Nobody's going to see you play. They're going
She's
to see
a flautist.
Mozart.
I didn't know that's what it's called yeah. for a flute player.
Yeah, it was
a
just
flautist.
A weird thing. I just remember saying, I don't know why you're criticizing pop music, which just shows that you don't listen to pop music. And because you play flute in an orchestra, it doesn't make you a better musician. Okay. It makes you a better flautist.
Right.
But
you're
in a cover band. Like, nobody's going to see, you're going to see Mozart, you're going to see Gershwin, you're not going to see the second chair
right.
flautist. Like, and if, you know, versus trying to be the composer yourself, it's a, whatever, that's
it
a
sounds
whole
like
thing.
That's a deeper situation. Seems like she's a bit bitter.
Right, exactly.
A bitter flautist.
But at that point, when you're saying, okay, so you get your certificate, what do you do with your...
Well, I went right after that, I had like another month or so left with my record deal, and... I was going back in, like, to just give it, like, another couple rounds in the studio, and I happened to run into... So the studio was above this towing company, this, like...
What's
I mean, everybody gets towed in Miami. It's Tremont Towing, and then it was just a random studio.
Could you hear, like, the garages and all
Not too
people?
Bad. They put some money into it, so it was pretty insulated. But I'm outside the studio, and I was kind of like... I was a cocky little shit at 17, 18. And I was off, like, just coming from the beach, going in there. And I ran into, there was these two guys, and it happened to be Jim Johnson
wow.
and Rocco from Rebel Rock. They were at Rebel Rock at that point. I don't know if they're still affiliated. And Jim, I think the first glance, he's a little bit intimidating. I don't know if you met him.
Explain who Jim Johnson is.
Okay, so Jim Johnson, to date, he produced Lollipop, Beyonce's Sweet Dreams. He did Trick Daddy, Trina, Pretty Ricky, ASAP Rocky.
Huge producer.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah. So Rocco and Jim came up to me, and they're like, hey... You know, what's going on? What are you up to? You getting your car towed? And I was like, ugh. It's like, no, I'm going to the studio. And Rocco's like, yo, this is Jim Johnson. He's a big producer. I'm like, everybody's a producer. Like, come on. And he's like, no, man. He's a Trina, Trick Daddy, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, all right. And they're like, here's my card. Like, you know, get in touch if you're interested in meeting up or whatever. So I go up to the studio and I'm just like chilling, waiting around. And I Google Rebel Rock, and I see, like, the discog, and I'm like, oh, shit. Like, this is real.
Yeah,
I gotta get the
deal.
Fuck out of this joint. And so I called, like, a few hours later, and Rocco picked up. And I'm like, hey, I met you guys at the towing place.
So they were getting towed? They weren't there for the studio?
No.
So just coincidence, just you're going to the studio, yep. And they're two huge like music people.
It changed
and
my
you
life.
Just and they're sitting there waiting for their car.
Yep.
And you're sitting there thinking like, oh, these guys can't even get into the studio above the 12th
right,
place, and
exactly.
They're calling themselves producers.
Oh my God, it's amazing. So crazy to think about because it's just like that day, that time. It's a trip. So yeah, so I went over to their studio, which was like a game changer. It was like this South Beach Studios on the beach, and I walk in and like they're making music. Like there's some music coming out of here. Like it just has that feel. There's plaques all over the walls. And I go in and sat down, and it was kind of like an interview process. I started playing the piano, like, because I just, like, really got good at, like, these five chord progressions and different ways to play it. That's all I can play. But I just nailed them.
Still all you need.
Right.
The flautist would be, like, right. Really impressed with this conversation now. yeah, you're right, though.
Yeah, so I played, and at that time, Jim had been working with, like, Rico Love and... He just had his crew. It was so cool thinking back, like looking back at it, because he had like a live bassist there, and he had, you know, Frankie was the guitarist, and they're all. It was set up like a band, and he was on the MPC, and so I played some stuff, sang a few things, and like within a few months, I was signed to a production deal with him. And I got in. I mean, I learned so much. He brought me into, I was a rookie. Like, and he brought me into like some big writing camps with like David Hodges, David Ryan Harris, Steve McEwen, Simon Wilcox. And this is like, 18, 19 area.
Yeah.
So I happened to one day get, Jim asked me if I wanted to do a session with him and Rico. And so I came in with one of those progressions. And we ended up writing a song called Save the Hero, which was supposed to be my first single. But then randomly Jim called me a few days after we wrote it. And he's like, you know, if for some reason, like, we, you know, a bigger artist wants this record, you know, would you be into it? And I was like, I mean, not unless it's like Mariah Carey or fucking Beyonce. Like, I mean, anyone else, I'd be like, I mean, I want to do it. Like, this is my thing. What is even being a songwriter, really? Like, you're not famous. So,
And all you wanted to do at that point was be famous?
No, I wanted to, like, there was this next tier of, like, performing and, like, that just, there wasn't, to me, I was still so premature into, I didn't catch those, like, highs that I catch now in the last 5 years in the studio when I was 18. It was just kind of like, okay, cool. This is the first step to like getting out there and like doing my thing. I mean, I was in a fucking really heavy duty relationship for a really long time at that point, and this was like my ticket out of Miami. And
that relationship?
Yeah.
You wanted out of the relationship?
Yeah.
Well, what was the relationship?
I started dating my first boyfriend that we were 14, 15, he was a few years older, and I was in that for a really long time, and it was really, really heavy. Yeah,
Why?
It was just really dysfunctional. He came from a dysfunctional family, and I mean, we're talking, like, as soon as I got my license, I was chasing him around, like, looking for him at different strip clubs, like, it was just really intense. But at that point, that was normal to me, you know, like, compulsive lying, and then he got really sick towards the end, like 5 or 6 years in, he was diagnosed with cancer. So I'm young and I'm dealing with like going and working with Jim and then spending 6 hours a day in the hospital with him, you know, going through chemotherapy and all that.
Did that normalize how crazy is because you're doing something so crazy like being in a hospital, or was it just like the extremes are so heavy that they both were weighing on you?
Yeah, the extremes were really heavy, and I was in a really
Was he still difficult to be with when he was sick?
Yeah, because for some reason, like right before he was diagnosed, he was I knew that he had been toying with the idea of breaking up, and he had met somebody, and I know that that was like, it was, I can't necessarily say he was, there was cheating. I know there was cheating. Yeah, there was a lot of that going on, but there was this one particular girl that I knew that could potentially pull him away from me. So when he got sick, it was like, okay, he needs me now. So this is my time to like really make it work. But in his first cycle of chemotherapy, he was, you know, before he lost his hair, he was still going out, and I could feel like this is really fucked up, but I still stuck with him because he just doesn't have a good support system. And so I was there, and the second that he went, it took about 3 or 4 months before he was cured. Once he started to get his health back, that at that point, I just made the decision to get out and move to LA. So when
and was that sort of, so that's all one fell swoop. You have this song that, and Jim's like, you know, you said if it's Beyonce, then you'll get, knock yourself out. And then he's sick and you're trying to get out of this relationship.
Right.
I mean, the weight of that one song, even if that's either your single or somebody else's, all that's going to be your ticket out.
Well, you would have thought, but it, I mean, there was a lot of talk about, so Beyonce ended up cutting the record because at that time, Jim and Rico had been working with her doing like Sweet Dreams and all those
big records. And how old are you at that point?
I was 18, 19, around there. Probably 19 then, yeah. And so,
how was your ego at 18 years old dealing with all this? Where you're now writing songs for Beyonce?
It was cut in half. I think it was like, you know, I had a lot of guilt because I was trying to like enjoy it, but I needed to be there with him, and I really felt like, you know, I just couldn't, the thought of him sitting there for so long alone just killed me. So I was juggling. It was a really tough time for me. I mean, but it, at that point, the song was, you know, there was talks that the song was going to be a single for Beyonce, and then it ended up only being a bonus track, which as songwriters, I don't think, because you might as well not even be on the record.
Yeah, I mean, they're hard to even find. Like when you get that, it's right. They're hard to find. And meanwhile, the sink or swim part of when someone says it's going to be a single, it ends up as a bonus track. It's like that happens more often than you think because the artist, they're going to write 8 songs, and the last 2 slots are really for the singles,
right?
And if you're the third, then they make you the bonus track.
Right.
And if you're the second, you're the second single.
Right.
You know, it's
exactly.
Like, it's that different of a, either you're going to make enough money for a long time or you're going to end up
and I had
searching
false...
for the deluxe album.
Right.
At, you know. In
exactly, at Target. You know, and that's what Target. I was doing. But I had this, I didn't really know how it worked. So I had this false hope that there's still a chance that it could come out, you know.
Right.
So I packed up and moved to L.A. and thought that based off of like that song, I would no problem be able to get a publishing deal and meetings and sessions. I mean, here I am.
I mean, it does show an insane amount of potential. If you're somebody in Miami who's writing a song at 18 years old that ends up on a 19 years old, that ends up on a Beyonce record, that's...
I don't know if it really helped because, I mean, at that point, I was working with a manager, Marilyn, but within like a year into living in LA, we parted ways. She was in Miami. So I didn't really, you know, Jim and I decided that we would stop working together. But the only connections that I really had were the connections from the writing camp that he put on with David Ryan Harris and Steve McEwen. So David Ryan Harris and I became really close. And I think that even though Jim and I like had kind of agreed that like we'd go our separate ways, I kind of still rode off of like, you know, I had to get in with David Ryan Harris, so I had to do what I had to do.
Did David Ryan Harris do?
David Ryan Harris was John Mayer's guitar player.
Okay.
And wrote stuff with him, and He's written a bunch of stuff. One of the most incredible writers. I would love to go back and work with him. He is an artist project as well. The most incredible, just soul, just would break your heart, his voice. And so we spent like a few months just pushing and making a demo for myself. And there was one song.
This was, you moved here to be an artist at this point.
Mm-hmm. And then
are you at this point, had you... Are you doing a long distance relationship or
sort of? Uh-huh. And yeah, so that was, yeah, it was. I mean, I needed. It was so scary. Like I've moved in with my stepmom's cousin, who I had only met once, and I mean, it was a nice situation, but it, you know, I was just, this is my first time like being away, and I don't know anyone, and yeah, it was really tough. It was the. Oh, God. Yeah, I was kind of just commuting. I rented a car commuting back and forth from David Ryan Harris's house. And we made some shit songs. And then we made one that is called Lonely Won't Come Around that ended up on Crystal Power Sox's album. And Crystal Power Sox, I think, like won first or second place in American Idol. Wow. So it was a big deal. Yeah. She was actually really rad. She's like dreadlocks and cool chick from like, I don't know where, but somewhere and like from like the Boondocks. And
but a cut, I mean, at that point, a cut's a cut.
A cut's a cut.
What people are buying. Still people are buying albums or singles or anything. So, you know, I'm sure it pops up in some different places, you know?
I love that tune. So from that point, actually Jim Johnson started to get kind of excited. I sent him that song. but it was still like, there was still, you know, there was just, he had so much shit going on with B.O.B. and like, you know, just, he was in Miami and it just was too tough. So I was still working with my manager, Marilyn, and by chance, she set me up on a meeting with Tom Maffei, who managed me for about 4 years. And he was at Pulse then. I took a meeting with him and he listened to all my demos and that's kind of where I made the shift from aspiring artist to aspiring songwriter. He told me that it makes more sense. Like my voice was just, I didn't have the thing. Like it just, I didn't have my identity sorted out. I was just kind of just scrambled. I couldn't really write from a personal perspective. And
why?
I don't know. You'd think it wasn't until a lot later that I was able to do that. Honestly, like it wasn't until like the past 2 years that I've been able to tap into that place once I got sober. We haven't really reached that point yet. So Tom Maffei managed me. He put me in a session with his dude Radio and Jorgen Ellefsen. At this point, I don't have a publishing deal. I'm pretty like strapped for cash. Like my dad, like it's looking, I mean, I thought about getting like extra jobs. So like, I just didn't know what to do.
When you were saying you were starting to say your dad, it was your dad cutting you off at that point?
Well, I mean, it was like, I'd been out in LA for about a year and a half and you know, but I was willing to do whatever I had to do.
Did they understand? I don't know what your family situation is. Did they understand what you were doing?
Oh yeah. I had the most supportive parents and my mom, you know, was the reason why she, you know, commuted me back and forth to Miami to work with Marty Cintrone from No Mercy, like after school every day, just doing it. And thank God for that, because I wanted to play soccer and go surf with my friends and smoke pot and shit, and like did not want to do anything related to music. But she pushed me in a positive way, and yeah. So
you start working with Jorgen Ellefsen, or the first time you meet Jorgen, and you know. Just some background. He wrote "You Drive Me Crazy" and
sometimes
"A Moment Like This," mm-hmm. like some pretty massive songs. So you get in with someone like that. That's other than Jim Johnson, he probably has, you know, the biggest credits.
Oh, yeah.
I assume, you know.
I was so intimidated, but I luckily, you know, his weakness was my strong point, and which was lyrics. And I had just, prior to that session, I had just written so much shit, just like concepts and lyrics and stories and all this stuff. And I walk in and we write a song and it comes out really quickly. I can't even remember the song, but he asked me at that point, he's like, you know, I'd love for you to come out to Sweden and write with me for, you know, a month or so. And I'm like, yeah, that'd be great. But like, I can't ask my dad for any more cash. I'm like, he's like, do you have a publisher? And I'm like, no. He's like, great, I'll sign you to my publishing deal, blah, blah, blah. We signed a publishing deal and I was out in Sweden, and that's when it started.
Wow.
Yeah.
At that point, did you split off from Jim Johnson, like officially?
Mm-hmm.
Was that an amicable separation?
Yeah, it was. We're still great. I mean, he taught me a lot. I mean, he really took a chance with me and wanted to potentially push me into doing what B.O.B. did, but I just wasn't ready. And I have so much respect for him and that whole crew. And but yeah, it was good. I mean, I was ready to just kind of do my own thing. And
were you able to separate at that point with your ex? Is that when that like officially separates, or is that still being dragged out?
Let's see. It was still
being dragged out.
Yeah. It was still being dragged out. I remember. Yeah. I was in Sweden and I knew there was, it just got even more shady.
Further you get, though, I imagine that, you know, it's probably, you know, your family, your friends, and this guy must be like, here you are in Los Angeles. Not that Miami's a small town, but you're in Los Angeles. Seems like you're killing it. You have songs out with Beyonce, even if they're on, you know, some deluxe, and you're about to go to Sweden because you're signing a publishing deal with one of the biggest songwriters. Were people like in awe, or was it sort of like,
it hadn't happened yet. It wasn't until Stronger. So I mean, we were talking like 7 years with this one person, and I just couldn't imagine my life without him, as dysfunctional as it was. And I didn't really have many friends in LA at all. Like, it was, a year and a half in, I was just still trying to find my way. And so when I was in Sweden, fuck, man, we were grinding. It was in the winter time, and it was tough. And
pitch black. Oh. I think people don't realize in Sweden during the winter, there is no sun.
No.
There's sun maybe between 11:30 a.m. and 1:45 p.m. during the height of winter.
Yeah, and there's like a significant age difference between Jorgen and I. And so I didn't really, I was just kind of out there by myself, and I was staying down.
Is that weird?
No, because he was like a dad in a way. He was, you know, I stayed with him and his family and his wife and his daughter who I love. And I'm just, but I'm still like, you know, my only like stability was stability, quote unquote, was Ryan back home. And I just thought that was, you know, enough for me to, whatever it was enough for me to like not feel alone, you know, to have someone to call.
Who's in the industry, you mean? Or no?
No,
Ryan.
In general. Yeah, right. Ryan was a boyfriend, so he was,
right.
Like, so the reason why I stayed was,
I
like,
see, okay.
Yeah, just because it felt like I had a purpose, you know? I was somebody to someone.
Right.
And, yeah, so we come back from Sweden, and Jorgen comes to L.A. Now, at this point, this is about a month after, I'm about 20 years old at this point, almost 21, still with Ryan. Until it was like 4th of July weekend. My mom was out visiting me. I didn't go back to Florida that weekend because I had some work to do. My mom came out, and that was the weekend that Ryan met his girlfriend that he's with now.
Okay.
So that was the night I got a call that he had been that there was something like I should be worried about. And I saw some pictures were posted. So on July 5th, I woke up with all this shit. And then I had to prepare for a session in Long Beach with David Gamson and Jorgen Ellefsen. And I'm like all out of sorts. Like, I couldn't even drive to the session. I'm like, I was so close to canceling that session. You have no idea. It's in Long Beach. Like, I mean, That alone is enough to cancel a session.
It's so funny. It's in his back house.
Yes. You know? I'm like, yeah. What the fuck?
Yeah.
So my mom, luckily, my mom happened to be there for sure. And my mom was like, we got to do this, you know, because she's not letting me cancel. So she drove me to Long Beach. We're listening, we're talking, and she's like, you know, Allie, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I was like in the passenger seat, curled over, like, just kill me then. Leave me here. I can't take it. And so we pull up at the session, and, like, David Gamson comes out with, like, coconuts and shit. Like, have some coconut water, and the dog's there. It was like, okay. So we sit down, we're going through concepts. Jorgen's tough. Like, Jorgen, when he, you know, he'll drill and drill and drill, and you better come with the concept. So we're going through shit, and I'm like, I don't know, what doesn't really make stronger? It's like a bit gimmicky, like I know Kanye said it, but like, ooh. And I know it's, you know, the famous Nietzsche quote, and but I was just like, I had to get that session wrapped up. I was like, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger? That's it, bingo. So, yeah, we wrote that tune.
Who sings that melody?
But, that's actually Jorgen. And then I came in with a nani, nani, tenfa, we fought over that melody big time. We had to take a walk around the block. We had to do it, literally, we had to take a cool off. Because luckily, David Gamson had my back. He's like, that's a great. I love that. We got to keep that. The me, myself, and I.
Did you know that it was a great song, or was it like at this point you've been writing for a while and you've done a lot of songs, you're not even in the mindset right now, it's distracting you from what's going on in your personal life?
Right. Well, no, because we had a sketch demo, and I laid it down and I was like, yeah, it's cool. David Gamson had a demo singer come in, this girl Chanel, can sing her ass off, man. And David Gamson produced the song Up, had her voice on it, and I got it sent to me, and I was like, oh, shit.
It's awesome.
This is awesome. Like, this feels great. And then nothing really kind of panned out. I played it for a few. I'm not going to, like, lay anybody out there on the line, but I did play it for a few A&Rs,
sure.
And they passed on it for Leona Lewis. And Jeff Aldridge, Jim Valutato, and Jeff Aldridge. Jeff Aldridge is with RCA at the time, and I think, right?
Something. Yeah, he was, yeah.
And Jim Valutato is my publisher at Sony because I did the Junction deal, whatever. And so Jim Valutato, I mean, back in Sweden, we get a call from Jeff Aldridge and Jim Valutato. Kelly Clarkson loves the record. She's going to cut it. We're going to get it to Greg Kirsten. He's going to produce it. And we changed the verse a couple times, and it ended up going back to the original verse. Kelly tweaked a few lyrics on the verses, didn't take any publishing, is a legend to me, like just the fucking coolest artist in the game. And I was able to go in and watch her record it with Greg Kirsten.
So you were there during that?
That's when I started to get my groove back.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I wish all artists saw how Kelly works, because she's such a good writer when she writes, that she accepts like when she's the songwriter and when she's the artist cutting an outside song. And she treats songwriters with such immense respect. Yeah.
She's awesome, man. I mean, I actually got to know her I'd met her a few times, but I really got to know her a couple months ago in Nashville. And yeah, she's really intelligent. She has no filter and she's just the most down to earth. I mean, I'd love to hang out with her more and like, you know, we have a similar perspective on life and religion and politics. She's just badass, man. It's really nice to see. Like, I'd love to, like, you know, that song obviously means the world to me, but now that I really know her, I'm going to really try and nail some more on her record.
How does that song go from, you know, even Greg Kurstin, she cuts it, you know, you were told Beyonce's song was going to be a single, ends up as a deluxe. This one, you hear how good she sounds on this song. You know, I mean, how confident were you at that time when you heard her sing, were you like, oh, this is a shoe-in? Or were you sitting there being skeptical? I mean, how does this become, it's the biggest song on all radio formats in the U.S. It's all over commercials. It becomes this cash machine.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, there wasn't, when she was recording it, I was like, yeah, we got this, no problem. I mean, I had never been through, like, you know, the trials and tribulations of like getting a song out and making sure it's a single. Cause now I know that things can change on the fly. So, there was actually another, we were pretty sure it was going to be first single, but something changed and Esther Dean, Brett James and Brian Kennedy wrote Mr. Know-It-All. And so that hit hard. Cause when Mr. Know-It-All came out, I was like, I had this idea about the first single. The first single is what you want, ultimately, right? And then...
You don't have to... As long as the first single does pretty well and it opens the door for this is the next project, you actually kind of want the second one.
Right.
Every time, but it's... You can't convince any songwriter in the world that that's the case.
No. Well, especially at that point. I mean, I was pretty devastated and like... Yeah, it was a nail biter. And at that point, like Spotify started to come up. So it hadn't really been, it was just the beginning, it felt like, of Spotify. And so the people were still buying off iTunes at that point. So I just made that cutoff point. And
are you feeling pressure to repeat at that point? I mean, how soon after when Stronger is huge are you feeling like, oh, I got to have a follow-up to this?
Yeah, like immediately. And that's where, I mean, I rode that high until I hit rock bottom.
It's weird. There's like this victory lap syndrome that I kind of think all songwriters go through when they have their first hit. Where it's everyone starts calling you, all the great artists, great labels, great writers, everyone, producers, they're all calling you to congratulate you. They all want you in the room. And it's so easy to just schedule yourself to, you know, to lose your mind. And it's sometimes impossible to, the celebrating is nonstop because you're just like, dinners and dinners,
right. Oh, yeah.
And drinks, oh, and yeah. Parties, and everybody's like, they want you there. You suddenly become, you know, you're not wanting to go in this session because you're in the car crying, and then you show up, you write the biggest song in the world, and all of a sudden, what happens?
I wasn't equipped. I didn't really have the relationships I have now with other writers and producers, and I mean, I was going into rooms, but I was just still testing the water. So I didn't know who I liked working with because I was only working with Jorgen for a really long time. So we tried to maintain consistency, but it's tough when he's going back and forth from Sweden. I'm getting pulled. I'm starting to see this whole other side of this industry that's like the fast and furious life of like, you know, fame and recognition. And I'm, you know, I get hooked on a date, I get set up on a blind date with Mike Elizondo, to meet James Valentine, who I dated for a couple years. So it's just like I'm in the fast lane. Like, it's going, and it's, and
are you writing, or are you just?
I was writing. I definitely was, but I just didn't have. I just didn't know. Like, I just didn't. Nothing was really sticking. I mean, there was, like, I got a bunch of album cuts. Like, I did. There was incredible things that happened.
You end up on X Factor, right?
I end up on X Factor. I have a. I mean, L.A. Reid signed me to a big song deal there, and I wrote with Sierra. There was a lot of great things. L.A. Reid introduced me to Simon, and Simon and I click. Like, we're
Simon Cowell.
Yeah, and we, I learned a lot from Simon, and I was fascinated by him. I mean, he's just, he's brilliant, and he's fucking cool, and he likes to party, and he's like, and I just, I hung around that whole scene for like 4 or 5 months. He wanted me to judge the X Factor, so I started going through the rounds of auditions with these, with Fox producers, and I mean, I got really close. It was between me and Paulina Rubio, and thank God that did not happen.
Why?
I was not ready for that.
Why?
That was like the beginning of the end of my party era.
What's your partying era? What do you mean by that?
Well, it's just really started with like the late nights. It was booze. It was like, you know, rosé and Adderall and shit here and there. It wasn't really, I didn't get heavy into drugs.
When did you know you had a problem?
When I couldn't write a song without a good buzz.
Wow.
For about 6 months, yeah. So we're talking like waking up and, yeah, I mean, the thermos was filled with some rosé.
So Stronger happens in 2012 or
right.
so.
Uh-huh.
And then when does this period of the
I'd
partying
say,
stop? When does X Factor stop? When do you
2014, start realizing? 2015.
So those like two, 3 years you're kind of still riding the high and away from Stronger.
Right. And when I started working on the X, I didn't get the position, obviously, as a judge, but Simon hired me as his... like the consultant for his acts.
Sure.
So I was kind of getting like the special treatment, which I got to like hang out in his dressing room, and I had his full attention all the time. And like, right. So we were kind of, and it was, I got to drink wine and champagne in his dressing room. But then, I mean, that's like 4 months of like me, I wasn't writing at all. I'm just like focused on, you know, building, like making sure that Simon groups win and like the choosing the best songs, and it was fun. Julian Bonetta and John Ryan and like a bunch of my homies were there, and it was just a big fucking party. I mean, we were all going for it, like just the wine. I mean, the wine and the coffee cups. I mean, I hope that we were all going for it. I think
right.
we
yeah,
were
exactly.
all going for it. I was definitely
right
going
for sure.
It. But it was there was a lot of stress in that, like. Fuck, man. And
did somebody say to you like, hey, you're a songwriter, you should do that? Or did somebody say you're drinking too much? Or was it a personal thing of, I kind of think I want to go back into sitting in a booth and writing?
Yeah, it was that. And I think that straight after the X Factor is when I realized that there's something wrong, because I was starting to crave the buzz, you know?
Right.
And we, about a month after X Factor, we started working on Alex and Sierra's album, and yeah, I found myself slipping into the same routine of like just drinking and drinking, and I felt like the king of the world though when I was doing it. It was just like the Adderall. There was like a weird chemical balance between the Adderall and the rosé that just like was like fucking heroin to me. I feel like whatever heroin is, but like just this like complete bliss of like nirvana. And I mean, that feeling only lasts for like a few hours, and then it gets pretty dark. But yeah, and so I mean, it just, you can't sustain with that. I just couldn't sustain, because I
so
felt
did
like
you go, how did you when you went you start going to rehab, or did you just quit?
I just quit. I hired a sober coach to come stay with me for about 2 weeks, and yeah, I mean, I just started going into the meetings, and I mean, I'd watched Jay Cash's journey. I lived with Jay Cash for a few months, and his wife Jamie Zelick is a really good friend of mine, and they really helped me get through it and get sober. And I mean, I was like, you know, at the tail end of my era with that shit, and I was watching Jay Cash just fly, you know, like he's happy and he's consistently writing great songs and he's like on top and he doesn't have to, and I'm there and mixing a drink in the kitchen, like, you know, all right, there's something, and I, without any cuts, yeah. You know, not, the phone isn't ringing for a couple months. And then, I mean, I dabbled in like consulting for Columbia Records for a year and a half, learned a lot there. But once I got sober, had the sober coach come in, was when my life completely changed.
Like, and that, and right after that's right when you, is that when the Cedric Gervais thing happened?
Like, prior, that was before I got sober. So right after that.
Wow. So when you listen to, the Cedric Gervais one wasn't really a hit, but it was a single where it features you. I mean, was that?
I don't even listen to it.
Because it pulls you back to that moment.
Yeah. It was a dark place that time, but
how do you then, from being sober, which has now been a few years, right?
Yeah, almost 2 years.
Did you immediately meet your co-writers on, you know, Brian Lee and Andrew Watt?
Four months into, you know, because I had to like get my bearings back on.
Did you have a new manager, new publisher?
Not yet. Yeah. But I had to relearn how to write a song without. That was my biggest motivation.
Right.
I mean, how long can you go into a session and discreetly be drunk? I mean, I was getting away with it. 90% of the time I was buzzed. So like I didn't know myself sober. I had no fucking clue. I was going into business meetings, killing it, closing deals, making money like that, but just waking up in the morning and forgetting what the fuck happened. So,
because it's all a party.
It's all a party.
You're just trying to keep that going on.
Yeah, I was having a fucking great time. I mean, and everybody was loving me and my energy. And like, I felt on the top of the world. And so now, like, yeah, I mean, I had to get my bearings back on. And I met Andrew Watt into being sober, and through that I had an amazing friend, Stephen Rabel, sober now and just starting to really get his career, and he's taking off, and Bonnie McKee, you know, going to meetings, and just I had a great support system that really encouraged me. Reading about Sia and her journey, it's just like, obviously there's something to this thing, like,
right?
You know,
we've noticed that. We've done just over a dozen interviews, and I think we've figured something like 70-80% of the guests that we've had are sober. It can't be a coincidence that people who are addicted or have an addictive personality also are creative, are addicted to working,
right? Yeah,
and they're emotional. A lot of them were suppressing emotion, and then this is how they let it out once they're finally sober.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I know you can relate to this.
Absolutely. I mean, you know. I feel like I've kind of shifted my addiction into music, which is, I'm trying to balance out now, but there's something, I finally get that high off of, like, flowing off, you know, on the mic or just catching onto a good lyric. And when I met Andrew Watt and Brian Lee, the first session we did, we wrote Let Me Love You. So
that's the first session?
Yep. The first.
You got to be kidding me.
I'm not kidding, man. Like, and that feeling was just like.
Did you know it was a hit then?
It felt like it.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I know there was a bidding war for that song.
Right.
I know.
I mean, it went on for like about close to a year until it actually came out. But yeah, we.
When did Justin Bieber hear it? After it was produced out, or did he hear it?
After it was produced, yeah. And Andrew Watt, is the main, like, he facilitated that whole.
Yeah, what a hustler.
Yeah, he's a different breed, yeah, dude. Yeah, I think he's going to run this fucking industry at some point. He almost is. So I feel like when he had a relationship with Justin heard it, cut it, but throughout that time, like, Brian and Andrew and I we had magic there. And
how soon after that did you write It Ain't Me?
We wrote It Ain't Me about a 6 months after it came, after Let Me Love You came out.
So you guys become kind of a writing team for
almost 2 years.
Yeah.
And we went to London, worked on Rita Ora. It just happens. Like, we write a song, and if it felt like something, like, it would, you know, it would get cut. And
are you guys considered a writing team now?
I mean,
it's kind of hard not to.
Yeah, but we, you know, we're all kind of in different, like, when we're all in the same city, those are the most enjoyable sessions for me. Even if we, like, are all in different places mentally, like, it's just, there's a love there that, like, you can't mess with. And we all bring, like, those sessions are there, you know, we all challenge each other in ways, but it's when we catch that rhythm, when we're all like contributing lyrics and having ideas and we feel it and we're just, it's, there's nothing like that. So I owe a lot of like gaining that high back to those guys, because they pushed me and they really built my confidence back up, and I really needed it. Like, so
When you, your first session with them, I mean, that Melodies has a moment going back to Let Me Love You, you know, it's the na-na-na part where you end on the dissonance after the first round, which allows you to resolve it and all this other stuff. Is that, using words like na-na-na is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Sticking with that melody is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I know Brian's like a virtuosic melody writer.
Yeah, he went for that, let's pull it down on the second one. I mean, he was pushing that. Him and Andrew kind of constructed that chorus melody thing, and then I jumped into the booth and kind of was freestyling the lyrics and going for it.
So crazy.
It was just...
Same thing with It Ain't Me? Is that sort of the same process you guys have?
Yeah, I mean... It Ain't Me happens so fast that, like, it blows my mind. I mean, we were in a session with Kygo, and we kind of started something else that wasn't too good, and then Brian picked up the guitar and started playing something and was going off of this melody. Andrew came in at that point, started tweaking it, we started going, and then the melodies, it was just like we were on that chorus, and Brian and I were kind of charging at that melody, and Andrew came in and tweaked. It was just like... It was just magic. Like, that song needed to come out of all of us. Like, it relates to all of us in so many different ways that it's like all of our story in one song. And it was like just this beautiful combination of like Fleetwood Mac with like just, I don't know, just with just honesty and like just that song was, yeah, that was a big moment for us. And I remember, like, when Kygo came in the room and listened to it for the first time right after we had written it, and, like, just watched his eyes kind of like, okay.
It just lit up.
Yeah, it was just...
Is it hard to... You guys are all in very different places when it comes to celebrating. The three of you are so, so different.
Right.
And not to get into too much of that, but is it hard to be... Is it hard the way you guys... are, because I mean, that the dynamic of the three of you probably is what makes you guys very special, but you're talking about sort of extremes in personalities,
right? I mean, you would think, but I've just kind of been able to manage it, and they have respect for me, especially in the writing process. Like, for the most part, I mean, we're all like, we're not getting fucked up in the studio. They're, obviously, I'm not, but they're not drinking around. And if we go out to dinner, we go, you know, we'll have a, it's like, feels like a family thing. And then when I'll hang out for as long as I can. And I mean, there's only so much I can do. Like, I've had such an incredible run being sober, and my life has completely changed. I'm like, the happiest I've ever been. So I can't be pulled back into that world.
Yeah.
I mean, and so I kind of go home and this has been the best year of my life. Honestly, I have a fucking wonderful, incredible boyfriend right now that just like helped me connect to other human beings sober and like find my truth and like just opens up my mind to so many different things in the world and just, you know, he's, so I'm just like in a really solid place. And just,
like, I know we could go into talking about things like religion and spirituality yes. and the planet and politics, oh, yeah. because I know you have opinions with all these things.
But I could really easily get myself into like a
I know we'll have to do a follow up.
Right.
But before we end, I'm gonna just list five things. We don't really.
Are we already at the time?
No, we're not. We have no time. We can keep going if you want. But let's. I'm just going to list.
Everybody's tuned out at this point.
We do this segment. Hey, this is about you.
Oh, thank you. Know? No, this was really good. This is like a really necessary release for me. I haven't spoken about this in a all these.
Well, this is important. This is important for a number of reasons for your story, but we'll get to that still in 1 second. I'm going to list five things. You're just going to name the first thing that comes off the top of your head. It's a segment we don't have any title for. It's called Five Things That I'm Going to Just List, and you're going to name a bunch of shit that comes to your head. Okay. Jürgen Olsen.
Magnificent.
Simon Cowell.
Gangster.
The co-producers of this podcast, your managers, David and Jeremy.
Ooh, fucking, like, hold on.
David Silverstein.
David Silverstein and Jeremy Levin. My heroes. My saviors.
I love that. Brian Lee.
Ooh. I'd say the god of, like, the god of the rebels. Let's do that.
Oh, I like that. Andrew Watt.
Ooh. And my best friend, the fucking pioneer.
Oh, I like that. I think if people don't know who Andrew Watt is, they should.
Pioneer.
They should figure
legend.
Out, first of all, Brian
Andrew,
Lee.
Andrew Watt
are,
is a legend.
Yeah.
Brian Lee is the god of the rebels.
Yeah. I love that. Andrew Watt is such an important personality that is just starting in the music
industry. Oh, yeah, he's going to run it,
yeah,
for sure.
It's really impressive.
He is genius. Genius, genius.
But I was going to say, you know, your story is so inspiring in the music industry because there are people who were in your position who climbed the top of the mountain, came back down, and that was the end. And they weren't able to figure it out. That is the story. That is the story of so many artists, so many writers, so many producers. There's so few people who went, climbed a mountain, came back down, and then climbed a bigger mountain. I mean, you are running on... This is a massive run for you because you are opening up, honestly, not just musically, by doing things like this. You know, you're giving back. You're acknowledging all the people who are involved in your career. And when you talk about the beginning of this conversation, you're saying how you have this ego and you walk up to these two huge producers in the street of Miami and be like, yo, I'm going in the studio, versus now where you're like, I owe this to, you know, David and Jeremy are my heroes, mm-hmm. and these guys are my saviors, mm-hmm. and with, you know, Cash and Jamie, that they're all these wonderful people that that are embracing your journey because you're a really positive influence to a lot of people here.
Thanks.
So
it means a lot.
You know,
I'm super grateful to be in this place right now. So it's been a journey for sure, but it feels worth it. So,
well, thank you for doing this. We'll do a follow up in, you know, 2 years from now.
When
you know, it's seven
talk,
more
we'll
songs.
We'll talk
out
Cosmos.
There. Oh yeah, 100%. All right, thank you so much.
Awesome, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to Jeff Sparger, David Silverstein from Mega House Music, and Michael White. Here's a sneak peek of next week's And the Writer Is.
When I met Bon Jovi, They had a very dynamic, legendary manager, Doc McGee. And so somehow, I got a chance to go and write with them. They had had kind of a not so successful second record, 7800 Fahrenheit or something like that. Yeah. And I went out to New Jersey and rent a car because I was living in New York. And we went to Richie's parents' house, which is where they were co-writing in the basement. And I got their little house, and it was in a kind of like at the end of this little cul-de-sac, and behind them was marshes. And at the very, like far away, were the refineries, the oil refineries. Like it was Emerald City over there. Can you imagine how toxic this place is?
Yeah.
And so I walk in, I make a left, I look to my left, there's a room, and that's Richie's room. Poster of Kiss, Farrah Fawcett in the, red bathing suit, typical, high school boys' room. And then you're right there in the kitchen, and John was on the wall phone, like this avocado green wall phone. And he's kind of like, kind of waves to me. And Richie, who's very, very nice and, very, very accommodating, said, why don't you just come downstairs and, I'll set you up, for our session. And so, I went down there, and it was the laundry room with it was literally the laundry room with some transoms, like muddy transoms around the side. And then an old Formica table that must have been retired from the kitchen, and this little keyboard that was kind of teetering on it, some amps buzzing. And finally, John came down. He was obviously doing big business on the phone, whatever. I had a title in my back pocket. So we started fooling around, writing this and that and the other thing. And I said, okay, I guess I better pull out the title. The title was You Give Love a Bad Name. Because I love, I haven't talked about my mentor, Bob Crewe, but he taught me about writing songs that have a lot of inner rhyming and irony. And having, once you have a title that tells it all, the song just spills out of it like a magic spell. And so John instantly responded, and he had had a song on his previous record called Shot Through the Heart. So he doesn't give up on his good material either. He just instantly said Shot Through the Heart, and you're to blame. Darling, You Give Love a Bad Name. And the rest was history.
Until next time, this is Ross Golan.